Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Dispatch Podcast. I'm Jamie Weinstein. My guest today is Natan Sharansky. Natan Sharansky was most famously a Soviet dissident who was imprisoned in the Soviet Gulag for nearly a decade for standing up for human rights before he made his way to Israel, where he is widely recognized as one of the world's leading human rights advocates. He served as minister in four Israeli governments, is the author of four books, including the influential The Case for Democracy, is the only non-American citizen to be awarded both the Congressional Medal of Honor and the Presidential Medal of Freedom. He also served for a time as the head of the Jewish Agency and is currently the chairman for the Institute for the Study of Global Anti-Semitism and Policy. We discussed many topics, including Israel's fight against Hamas in Gaza, what is going on college campuses. And we opened with questions and comments about his letter exchange with the recently killed Russian dissident, Alexei Navalny. Without further ado, here is Natan Sharansky. Natan Sharansky, welcome to the Dispatch Podcast.
Thank you for inviting me.
There's many topics I want to discuss with you, what's going on college campuses to what's going on in Israel. But I want to begin, since you're here and your experience, and just ask you about what your relationship was like with Alexei Navalny and where you were when you heard about his passing.
Well, I didn't know Alexei Navalny. I knew, of course, a lot of about him, and I followed with some kind of excitement and I think very inspiring career, if you can say, and the way how he unmasked the efforts of KGB to poison him were really spectacular. Still, I didn't know him personally, and when I received a letter from his prison, I was really excited. He wrote me a letter after he read my book on memoirs and was surprised how similar was our situation in prison then with his situation today. But for me, it was like to get a note from my alma mater, which I graduated from many years ago. And immediately we both felt like kindred spirits, because free people in prison, and as I was writing him that by remaining free in prison, you are influencing on millions of unfree people on both sides and all parts of the world. And then we had short but very emotional exchange of letters, and then it stopped when his lawyers could not continue to do it. It was clear for me that Alexei Navalny is ready, or he's optimistic about historical struggle, and he said that my book adds him some optimism, but he was ready for everything. Still, I have to say it was very shocking to find out about his death. I would not call it death, I would call it killing in cold blood, whether it was killing by poison or by fists or simply by keeping him 300 days in the punishing cell. By the way, it's unheard type of torture. I had half of this term in punishing cell, and I can say how difficult it is. So, but in the end, it was clear that the aim of Putin was to kill him, and he reached his aim.
The letters between you two have been released, and they're remarkable. I guess my only other question on this is, where does such courage come from for someone like Alexei Navalny and someone like you to, in the case of Navalny, coming back to Russia, knowing that you will probably be imprisoned and very probably killed? And as a corollary to that, as you mentioned, in those letters, it's kind of amazing how free he seems in those letters, despite being in a gulag, in a prison in Russia. How do people remain free in such a circumstance?
As I mentioned, by the way, in one of the letters, I was really infuriated, I would say. I was very irritated by some questions of the journalists BBC journalists and some others on the day when he went back to Russia. They were telling, we all understood that he will be arrested. He didn't understand such a simple thing. Is he naive or is he stupid? Why did he go? And I had to tell them that it is they who don't understand something, that if he was fighting for his physical survival, then he would never go to Russia and maybe even never will start his struggle. But because he was fighting for many years to influence on his own people, that they should not be afraid of this system, that they should resist to this tyranny. So that was the best which he could do, the best way that he could deliver this message. I am not afraid of Putin. You also should not be afraid. And the fact that he is not afraid because he is a free person. When you start the struggle and suddenly you feel such a relief that you can do really what you want to do. And you feel yourself part of big historical process, great historical struggle, and you feel how important is every step that you're doing to unmask this regime. It gives you strength to continue, and you even in prison, you prefer to be free person than so many loyal Russian citizens who are not free, who are scared, who are afraid, who are silent, and so. So, yeah, well, I understand this feeling very well, and that was exactly the way how I felt in prison. And that's why it was such a almost joy, I would say, to have a dialogue with this free person in the Russian prison.
I want to turn to what's going on the college campuses, which has been a theme of this show. You wrote about this in December in Tablet magazine. And let me just quote the opening of your article. You wrote, 20 years ago, after my first trip as a government minister to 13 college campuses in the United States, I told Ariel Sharon, then Israel's prime minister, that in my opinion, the main battlefield for the future of the Jewish people lies in American academia. Since then, I appeared dozens of times at different universities, and with each visit, I witnessed the new anti-Semitism growing stronger. You go on to say, in light of this experience, I insisted in many conversations with liberal American Jews that while left and right-wing anti-Semitism are connected, and both are very dangerous, it is left-wing variety that poses the greatest threat. Explain what you meant by that.
You know, for a liberal Jew, probably for liberals in general, it's so easy to believe that progressive, those who are speaking about freedom for everybody. But what we have to do for this is to help the oppressed, to fight against the oppressors. And so in order to create the world where everybody is equal, it sounds like a great idea. And even if you have to pay some price and there will be some injustices on the way, for the sake of this great idea, of course, you will feel solidarity with the struggle. That was exactly why I understand it very well, because that was stationed with many liberals about Soviet Union. And even in the days when Soviet Union was doing some of these most awful crimes, when Stalin was killing millions, there were some liberals, including liberal Jews in the West, who were saying, but it's such a great idea, so let's see where the direction is, and let's find a way how we can express solidarity to make sure that there will be that it will be less blood, less victims on the way. But the idea is very good, and the fact that they heard it in different forms, again and again, from some liberal Jews. For example, there was a big debate about Women's March on Washington. 1 million women. It was like 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And it was clear that the leaders of this march are anti-Semites, are haters of Israel. It has nothing to do with liberalism. But many Jewish women's organizations were saying, but the idea of the equality of women is so important for us. So let's join it, even that we have our own reservations. And that was the problem, my problem with my friends, liberals, and I myself also believe, though very often I'm called conservative, I believe that I am no less liberal than conservative because I do believe in human rights, do believe in equality, in progress, and And here people are taking this neo-Marxist approach, all this woke movement, it's typical neo-Marxism. It divides all the humanity on the oppressed and oppressors. You say that oppressed is always right. Oppressor is always wrong. We should not give freedom of speech to oppressor because it will make it more difficult to oppress. We should permit only to oppress speak. And so on and so on. It's all Marxism, Leninism of my childhood. And we know what was the result, how many millions of people were victims of this ideology. So, unfortunately, for we needed such awful thing as this gang rape, sadistic killing, burning of the people alive, and so on, what happened on the 7th of October. Any reaction on this by some progressive, that is the real liberation. That's the beginning of the liberation of the world. And definitely only Israel should be accused of this. And the fact that all those human rights, so-called human rights organizations, didn't show any sympathy to the victims, that women's organizations of America didn't express any sympathy to the most awful rape and torture of women for centuries. Find such description of such sex violations which happened on this day. You will not find them. You have to go 400 years ago to pogroms of Khmelnytsky in order to see something which looks a little bit like this. And so it was not condemned by any of these organizations. I asked, recently I was meeting, I meet a lot with Jewish Zionist activists from Ivy League universities. I said, was there any group, student group, which expressed publicly sympathy and solidarity with you when these awful things happened? And they were all thinking they couldn't find one. Then finally one said, no, we have, in the Yale, we have Buckley Society, like Federal Buckley Society, something like that. That's the only organization which expressed publicly some sympathy on the campus to this unbelievable, awful thing. So, well, and Buckley Society, understand, it's not exactly a liberal society, but they, I don't know. I don't want to give reference. I'm very glad that they express it, but they, among those many groups who are fighting for human rights, they couldn't give me even one more example. So that's what I meant for years when I was saying that the most important problems between liberals and progressives. And liberals have to understand that progressives are not their allies. They are not fighting really for human rights because the rights of oppressed, in this case of Hamas even, you have to fight for, and the rights of oppressors don't exist. They don't have any rights in this case Israel. That was their ideology for many years, and it's a pity that you need such awful events in order to start understanding who are your real allies and who are not.
My question, I guess, is how did this occur at the most elite universities? It's usually the worst we're seeing at the most elite universities, where you have students who are effectively participating in pro-Hamas demonstrations. As you mentioned, you have heads of organizations who refuse to stand up for the women in Israel who were brutally attacked on October 7th. How did this ideology spread so quickly and become so prominent to where at universities you have college presidents who seem so afraid to even stand up and support Israel after what you suggested, and I think is correct, probably the worst attack on Jews since the Holocaust?
No, it didn't happen so quickly. Let's not make our task easier, saying, well, it's happened so quickly that we didn't notice, as many people say. 20 years ago, I said to Ariel Sharon that campuses are the most important battlefield. It was before woke movement, before microaggression, before canceling tactics and political correct tactics. So it was long before. What really happened, there was Professor Said, who came, who said to Yasser Arafat, by the way, he openly, he wrote it, that the struggle of our people against Israel should not be kept as a conflict between Jews and Arabs. You have to put it in the veiled conflict, and then it will be much easier to accept. He built a theory of anti-colonialism. That was the beginning of all these critical theories, where colonialism is always wrong and victims are always right. And he said that Israel is colonialism. And I have to say, it was already then that many liberals were accepting this theory of Said as part of their world of human rights. And then, if you remember, there was a conference, Durban Conference 2000, where the only result of this the first anti-racist conference of the United Nations in the world finished only with one result, that Israel was declared to be apartheid state. So that was the time when it was had to be clear that simply the slogans of human rights and anti-racist slogans, anti-colonialist slogans are used or make a kind of union with pure anti-Semitism. And when I was visiting these universities, I saw how it is influencing the students. They are liberals. They understand that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. But in the view of this new world fight to oppress against oppressors, they felt some kind of discomfort. Then it was real discomfort. It was fear to be not with the what is fashionable today. And as one of liberal Jews then, 20 years ago, told me in one of the Ivy universities, that for me as liberal Jew, it will be better if Israel doesn't exist. Then I don't have to talk about it. I really don't want to talk about it. And in fact, I'm speaking about Jews, but in fact, it was general thing that liberal world started accepting these neo-Marxist ideas as part of its own world. So tradition, and at the same time, the pure anti-Semites on the left and the right, their number is increasing, and more people coming from Muslim countries, and some of them loyal to fundamentalist movements, are becoming students of the universities. So on one hand, the number of people potentially sharing anti-Semitic views is increasing. On the other hand, there is such a worldwide broad ideology which liberal camp adopts. And on the wings of this ideology, anti-Semitism goes like a flood over all the universities. And then when three presidents said what they said in the Senate, by the way, I told, we have to be very grateful to them. Really, somebody said, so you think we have to pay them salary? I think even pension, not only salary, because all of our organizations together for 20 years of working and explaining what is anti-Semitism and how deep it is in the candidates' life, we didn't succeed to explain it as well as they. Because what they said, they were asked about killing of Jews, and they said, they asked yes or no, they said it depends on context. Why they said, are they anti-Semites? Of course not. But they had to go back to their campuses, to their students, to their professors, who believe that as a part of liberation movement, it's okay to kill Jews. Because they're not Jews, they're Israelis, they're settlers, they're racist, they're colonized, it's okay to kill them. So that's why they say it depends on context. If it's speaking about simply Jews, we are against. If it is speaking about part of liberation struggle, maybe partially it's possible. So, and we are not speaking about some anti-Semites. We are speaking about the leaders of the liberal thought today on the campus. And they are imprisoned by this racist, anti-Semitic book.
And we'll take a quick break to hear from Tax Network USA. Do you owe back taxes? Pandemic relief is now over. Along with hiring thousands of new agents and field officers, the IRS has kicked off 2024 by sending over 5 million pay-up letters to those who have unfiled tax returns or balances owed. Don't waive your rights and speak with them on your own. They are not your friends. Tax Network USA, a trusted tax relief firm, has saved over $1 billion in back taxes for their clients, and they can help you secure the best possible deal. Whether you owe $10,000 $10,000 or $10 million, they can help you. Whether it's business or personal taxes, even if you have the means to pay or you are on a fixed income, they can help financially resolve your tax burdens once and for all. Call 1-800-245-6000 for a private, free consultation or visit tnusa.com/dispatch. And we'll take a quick break to hear from Aura. Looking for the perfect gift to celebrate the moms in your life? Aura frames are beautiful Wi-Fi connected digital picture frames that allow you to share and display unlimited photos. It's super easy to upload and share photos via the Aura app. And if you're giving an Aura as a gift, you can even personalize the frame with preloaded photos and memories. And I'll tell you, not only have I given this picture frame to all the moms in my life, but I'm an only child, and it's been really fun to see my friends with siblings give this frame to their moms, and it turned into a passive-aggressive war to see which siblings can upload more pictures of their children. The Aura app is so easy. You can sit there at the end of the day while you're watching TV and just upload a couple pictures from the day and really show your brother-in-law who's boss. From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, and even the friends in your life, every mom loves an Aura frame. Named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things, Aura frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code DISPATCH at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
We had last week on the show, David Brog. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He was the head of Christians United for Israel for a while. And he says this ideology is actually spreading to young evangelical Christians in the United States. Evangelical Christians are probably the most pro-Israel group in the United States. But now the younger generation is subscribing to some of this ideology and becoming less pro-Israel. And I guess my question to you, which I haven't found an answer, and I've had a lot of guests on, how do you reverse what is going on? How do you reverse now that it's spread to these elite institutions, to the Ivy Leagues, to beyond that, to political party leadership in certain parties, and now potentially to youth movements that were traditionally pro-Israel are now kind of becoming subscribing to this ideology and as a result becoming less pro-Israel? It seems like a real problem for Israel.
As to Israel, I have to say, and I am dealing a lot with the representatives of young representatives of Israel who are sent to different communities, Jewish communities, to the campuses. I initiated such a program 20 years ago, which today is very important. I always explain or tell them my view. My view is you don't have to convince those who hate us that we are good people. You have to convince Jews that they have nothing to be ashamed of, and they have a lot of reasons to be proud of. And I really believe that if we will stick to our way, and if we will continue to be the only democracy, and if we fight for human rights as we always fought, but without these false partners, and if we really believe that our partners, like evangelists, they also believe these human rights. And we have all simply to show again and again how, and today is a very good example, how this policy has nothing to do with human rights, has nothing to do with equality, has nothing to do with freedom. And to stick to our course, that's what we have to do. Now, if I were an American politician, I would be very concerned what it means for the future of United States of America. Not for the Jews of United States of America, of course, but what it means for the federalists of United States, for the principles on which United States is built, for United States being the defender of human rights all over the world. I think it's a big tragedy. It's always anti-Semitism is the first warning that something is wrong inside society. And it's very serious warning to American society, what's just now happening. So yeah, I think it's not, we have to make sure that Jews understand that it's against them and should not be partners of those who are supporting anti-Semitism, and will continue defending the values in which we believe. But Jews as Americans, and everybody as American, should think very seriously where these anti-American, anti-human rights, anti-liberal ideologies, where they take them. So it's my challenge to you, not challenge to me. What you Americans have to do in order to stop this awful thing which threatens to the freedom of the world. I was one of the dissidents behind the Iron Curtain who knew that if there will be no America, if there will be no Reagan's and Thatcher's, we will be doomed. So the fact that the leaders of the free world understand how it is important to defend the basic values, how it is important that rights of the women will be the same whether they are called oppressors or oppressed. Without this, America is lost. No, I'll give only. Okay, that's a no.
I want to turn to Israel in a second, but before I do, we now officially this week have a race between Joe Biden and Donald Trump in America for the next president. I was wondering if you had an opportunity over your long career meeting either or both of them, and if you have any thoughts of what they are like personally.
Well, I met Senator Biden and then Vice President Biden a number of times. I didn't meet him at the time when he was a president, but I know him very well many years ago as a very warm person and very sympathetic to Israel and to Jews. And, well, I don't want to interfere into your elections. We have enough problems with our elections, but I want to say that if it was election about personality, well, for me, Biden is an excellent personality. The problem is that they saw 40 years ago, and not 20 years ago when I knew President Biden. It's today. And today there is a big challenge coming from the left, progressive anti-democratic movement. To what extent he can count? By the way, 4 years ago, I was answering and I was saying that my concern are whether he can control it. And I was told, what are you talking about? There are some overexcited students of the campuses. It cannot be a problem for the president of the United States. He knows now that it is a big problem. And I don't know whether he is strong enough to deal with it. On the other hand, President Trump, I didn't meet. Well, I met him on different receptions before he was a president. I didn't meet, and he did a lot of good things for Israel when he was a president. But the fact that he believes that he can make deals with Putin, that when he was in China, in China, he was speaking how the people love their leader. He doesn't understand the nature of relations between dictator and the people. And I'm concerned that progressives will become more powerful, and they are very powerful already in the universities. God forbid if they'll become more powerful in the politics. And I'm afraid that the American president will start making deals with Putin and will betray Ukraine, and not only Ukraine, but the interests of the free world.
Just one more question on this. I don't know if you have any kind of tying it to my first question about Navalny. One of the campaign comments that President Trump is saying on the tail that he is like America's Navalny because of the cases that are being brought against him. And I just wanted to know if you had any thoughts of the president using, or the former president using, Navalny in that way.
Well, no, I think it's very unfortunate. When I was released from Soviet Union, there were many people from prisons, writing me, including American prisons, who were writing me and explaining that their case is exactly as my case, that it's unjust and so on. And I was also always answering them that you're lucky to be in American prison and not in Soviet prison. So, not wishing them to be in prison, but simply trying to show them the principal difference. There is their dictator is trying to destroy any dissent movement and is using everything, including killing him. And it's like mafia. And here, I will not judge about all these trials, but America is a free country, still free country, with independent courts. And exactly as we are angry when the other countries of the FIMEO, some international institutions, are trying to undermine our democracy by interfering, I don't think that we, public opinion of the world, should be trying to undermine American juridical system. President Trump has to be very lucky that he goes through the juridical system of the United States and not through the juridical system of Putin. And these comparisons are absurd.
As we speak, what would you say the mood is in Israel?
Well, look, first of all, it's very traumatic time. I believe that trauma of the 7th of October will stay with our generation and maybe even goes beyond it. Because really, we lived with the feeling that for the first time in history, Jews have their state, which defends us. And not, it was not the state of the people. Everybody serves in the army, everybody is involved. And suddenly, 1,200 people were killed in the most awful way, and the state, for a few hours, the state was not there. And that's a failure which will be studied with conclusions will be done. So, on one hand. On the other hand, mobilization, volunteer mobilization of the people was immediate. In one day, we became from the most polarized society. For a year, there were demonstrations. Half of the country believed that the other half of the country or is stealing our democracy or is stealing our Jewish character. And it was such an awful polarizing in the society. In one day, we became the most united society. And now we discovered that all what we were fighting about is really not important. And it's really bottom of the surface. But in fact, deep in the heart, we are very passionate, very courageous, very united people. And there is a lot of, with all the tragedies which are happening, and of course, falling of the wild Jews, there's a tragedy, but there are so many good energy, which is coming from our people. So I'm much more optimistic. I'd like to be as optimistic about America as now I'm optimistic about Israeli society.
It seems from my perspective in America, there has been increasing calls. You're seeing politicians become less supportive than they were on October 7th. And you kind of see that, I think, around the world. Does Israel feel that pressure or are Israelis seeing those calls, or are they still focused on trying to prevent Hamas from taking back Gaza?
Of course, Israel feels this pressure, but it's an interesting reaction. Well, always when there was pressure, they start political debate, who has to be more blamed for this pressure, on the left or the right, and so on. It doesn't exist today. Israel is so shocked by the attack of Hamas, and so united, unanimously, from left to right, that we have to destroy Hamas. If we will not destroy Hamas, Israel will not survive in the Middle East. And Israelis are so angry that just this most awful act of violence after the Holocaust brings so much anti-Semitism all over the world. As I mentioned, there is so little sympathy expressed by groups in the free world, and to the contrary, it's like marching order for new anti-Semitic campaign. So that becomes so clearly expressed that Israelis at this moment almost don't care. They almost don't care about political pressure because they're absolutely sure that we have no choice. We have to, in order to guarantee the existence of Israel, we have to destroy Hamas, and that we have to be much more united as people, because anti-Semitism is coming back big. And the fact that anti-Semitism is coming back big is much more has much more influence on the mind of people than the fact that some of our good friends from America or other countries are saying the words of criticism. So even sometimes when this criticism is correct, and there are sometimes, not often, but the criticism is justified, today, because of this atmosphere, because of the atmosphere of tolerance to anti-Semitism, Israelis are almost insensitive. They don't feel pressed with this criticism. They feel they are mobilized to finish their immediate task to destroy Hamas and then to start dealing with the bigger problem of survival of Jewish people.
Is there any, I'm starting to encounter this sometimes in the United States where, you know, there's some people that will say, I'm pro-Israel, but I don't like how Benjamin Netanyahu is conducting the war. Can you speak to whether there would be any major difference if, for instance, Benny Gantz was prime minister right now in the way he's conducting the war versus Benjamin Netanyahu?
I have to say that the fact that somebody does agree with Benjamin Netanyahu, as you know, at least half of the country does agree. But not about the way how he handled the war. They don't agree about his attitude to many things before the war and his attitudes to many things which are happening every day. The way, I am sure, if today Gantz was the leader, the war will continue exactly the same way. And it's not accidental that in the cabinet of war, so-called, where Gantz and Bibi sit together, there is no disagreement about the war itself. It will be easier to have a broader government, probably because of all the battles of the past, many people are not inclined to become partners of Netanyahu. But whether the war will be dealt differently, no, I think that people, the army is determined, and politicians are helping to the army to do what everybody expects them to do. And as I said, we have a people's army. So practically every family is, one or another way, is involved. And whatever were the disagreements, and whatever are some other disagreements on other issues, the question of the war and how to deal with the war and how to deal with Hamas, there is unbelievable unity.
Are you surprised that the Arab Accords, the Abraham Accords, have maintained throughout this war? I mean, is that something that you expected?
I think the best proof that these accords were not built on some, like Oslo Accord, simply we will find the dictator who will force his people to live in peace with us. That these accords were absolutely different. They were based on the desire, big desire of the people to accept one another, of the peoples. And we saw it from the very first day, what happened between the people of Emirates and Bahrain and so on. And the fact that in spite of this war, but in all the other conditions, it could be very difficult for these countries to continue diplomatic relations, that in spite of all the pressure on them, in spite of, I don't know, Kuwait money and everything else, they are they stick to these accords. That's the best proof that the base of these accords was very healthy. And I am sure that it's a question of a very short time when we'll broaden these accords, including Saudi Arabia.
What do you envision the day after Hamas is defeated? What does Gaza look like? How is it run? Do you have your own concept of what you think will happen or what should happen after Hamas is defeated?
I have the same concept as I had 15 years ago when I was against disengagement. I was proposing to Ariel Sharon, instead of this, to support Palestinians who want to build civil society. Recently, I wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal together with Palestinian activist Bassem Waid, and I believe that after the war, with all the difficulties of your military control, has to be Israel has to guarantee security in military terms for years to come. As to the civilians, we have to encourage representatives of Arab countries, which recognize us, together with America, a representative of America, that they will find Palestinians and will start building the civil society. The only demands which we have must have from this civil rule is that there will be no education of hatred, that the education has to be changed, like in the Emirates it was changed, and the absolutely new generation of different type of educated Arabs have to grow there, that economy will be private and not belonging to dictator, and that's how Arafat and then Hamas was dictating everything to their people, that instead of refugee camps, there must be normal housing, and that human rights organizations will be permitted and supported. And only after years and years of such a rule, when we guarantee our military security, and they're trying to build civil society, we can come to normal negotiations about the future of this other. Only when there will be rulers who are interested in the well-being of their people and not in destroying us.
What is the likelihood that the Saudis or the Emiratis would help out there? They seem to not want to be involved.
Yeah, I think as long as Hamas is alive, or it can return to power. That's what their main demand or exchange of the release of hostages. That first of all, they will be permitted to stay at power. As long as they are in power, there is no chance that any of the Arab countries will be involved. The moment Hamas disappears from political and military scene, and there is a need for civil leadership among Palestinians, I am sure that Arab countries, those who recognize us, those who deal with us, will be ready to start dealing with the building of the future of Palestinians together with Palestinians.
Let me close with this a couple more questions. It's been almost 20 years, or maybe it's been 20 years since your famous book, The Case for Democracy. I remember reading it as a college student. I wonder, looking back, reflecting on it, are you still as confident in democracy, liberal democracy today, as you were then?
Look, the original name of the book was The Case for Freedom. But publisher said that people don't understand freedom is too abstract. Let's put it in democracy. But what I was saying in the book, that all the people want to live in freedom. And we have simply to support it, to give them such an opportunity. I would say that, there are many societies where civil institutions are not developed. By the way, President Bush, who became a big, my best book agent that I ever had in my life, but and he really liked the ideas of this book, but there was one idea with which we all disagreed. I was saying that democracy, it's not about elections. Free elections in a free society, that's democracy. And so the fact that people of Iraq were given the opportunity to have elections, President Bush believed that will be then. That's nothing if there is no free society. The same about us, that Condoleezza Rice was coming and pressing us to have elections. And I was sitting in the White House and saying, at least don't call it free and democratic. It has nothing to do with free and democratic elections. So the free world didn't prove itself as a friend of liberty and democracy when it's coming to the third world. Even if at some moment there is great period of spring revolution, how it was called, in Arab world, Arab Spring, and if you see descriptions of people who were involved in this revolution, it's exactly like descriptions of us behind the Iron Curtain. When people stop being afraid, and that's the end of the dictator. But then after this, there is a very difficult period of building civil society. The free world cannot do it for instead of that. But we all can decide that we are not supporting dictators. We are encouraging, we are linking our relations with them by the fact whether they are supporting or developing civil society. And I have to say, if I'm disappointed, I'm disappointed that we, the free world, didn't have enough proofs that we are ready to support such a side, that we will not prefer to deal with a dictator whom we know and not with a democracy that we don't know where it will go. So, yeah, I do believe, and there were some moments in history which prove that it's right to believe that all the people want to be free. I think free world can do, not by imposing it, but by encouraging it, can do much more than will be happening.
You anticipated my next question by mentioning George W. Bush. He was probably the biggest proponent of the book. Do you still keep in contact with him, or do you guys still talk?
Yeah. Bush has President Bush has a great institute, freedom, whatever it's called, freedom, supporting democratic dissidents in many countries of the free world. He has a great board for their representatives of the Republican Democratic Institute, the Democratic Party and Republican Party, leading specials in supporting democracy and vote. I'm also on the board, and I am happy from time to time to have the opportunity to speak in his presence to discuss things. Last time it was probably a year ago. So, even with some disagreements, I am very glad that the free world had a leader who understood the importance of this desire of people to be free. As he told me once, I always thought that freedom is not American invention. That's the gift of God. And I'm glad that you succeeded to explain what I didn't succeed. But he wanted to make a compliment. But it's very important that there is a person who understands the power of freedom. The one who understood and put the policy even much stronger, of course, is President Reagan, who was the only leader who then said that Marxism will be the
ash heap of history.
Because why he believed it? Because people who are, regimes who are depriving people of freedom are doomed to failure, and that they will not that people will not agree forever to save this regime. And he was, now that I'm reading the archives and future powers of the White House, you can see how human rights, how he had deep linkage between Star Wars, human rights, binational relations, and he saw it as one concept of security, human rights. And that's why he saw what is evil in communism. I think he played a unique role in bringing down the Iron Curtain.
Finally, I want to give you an opportunity to explain to Americans what Israel is currently fighting against, what it's like to be in Israel, and what you want them to know about Israel's current struggle.
Israelis, all Israelis, by the way, on the left, on the right, they, and not only Jews, by the way, they feel very strongly that that's the moment when we struggle for our right to exist as people in the state, in the Middle East, that that we went like through the most awful, sadistic massacre and rape, like rape of the nation. We as a nation feel ourselves raped and humiliated, but it's not the revenge which we are looking for, because we are too big. We are looking on the history of 1,000 years, but we understand that if after this we will not destroy our enemy, in the situation of Middle East, the weak cannot survive. The one weak who can be attacked in such a way and will permit their enemy to exist, it means that we will disappear. And that's feeling very strong, that Israelis have anger and feeling of that we are fighting for our security. But and because we have People's Army, we are the state of the people, so there was the quickest mobilization in our history. The army asked immediately, one day, to mobilize 300,000 people for such a small country. 380,000 came. So people were not waiting for the orders to come. People were coming from the universities from America. We were flying from Paris, from everywhere. Everybody felt that is the moment when we have to fight. And with this feeling of unity around fighting, we live every day. At the same time, Israelis feel, well, we feel it very often as Jews inside human history. We feel that that's also the struggle for the future of the free world. Because if that type of tolerance, which was given by the free world to not only unliberal, to the terrorists, to the ideologies which bring terror to this world, If it will continue, if nobody will be fighting with their weapons against it, then terror will threaten to all the world. And here I, as the one who is closely involved in defending Ukraine, I can say that there is some kind of similarity. And I was a number of times in Ukraine, met with Zelensky during the war. And the similarity is, at least on the level of Ukrainian leaders, there is strong feeling they're fighting for the future of free world, because free world will be very different. And not the rules of the existence of free world will be very different if Ukraine, if Putin will win. And here we can say, if God forbid, we will permit to Hamas to survive this awful thing, terror will become much more powerful in our world. So yes, Israelis at this moment feel that's by the way, we have a lot of tragic and heroic stories every day with the soldiers and with their families of the soldiers who were killed. And a lot of noble examples. But the feeling is that is the struggle for our existence, which we never had before. And that is the struggle for the future of the world. And if there are so many people in the world who are not with us, but with Hamas, so it's worse to them. It's almost not our business. Our business now to win and let our friends who try to convince the world that it is in their interest.
Natan Sharansky, thank you for joining the Dispatch podcast.
Thank you.